Brethren, on September 30th, 1938, the then Prime Minister of England, Neville Chamberlain, stood on the runway of the Heston Aerodrome just outside London and spoke to the crowds the following words. Quote, "The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is in my view only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler, and here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you." After reading the document, he closed by stating, "We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again." Unquote. Later that same day, Mr. Chamberlain stood outside 10 Downing Street in London and declared, quote, "My good friends, for the second time in our history, a British Prime Minister has returned from Germany bringing peace with honor. I believe it is peace for our time. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Go home and get a nice, quiet sleep." Unquote. Less than a year later, after this compromise agreement with Hitler, Hitler's continued aggression and his invasion of Poland prompted declarations of war by both France and the United Kingdom on Nazi Germany and its allies. Mr. Chamberlain, as did the rest of the world, learned a hard lesson from this experience. When it comes to evil, there can be no compromise. You know, just as this generation of men and women were called upon to fight a war against the tyranny of the Nazi Axis powers, we too have been called to fight a war. However, our war is not against flesh and blood, but as Ephesians 6:12 states, our war is against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Brethren, we must be fully dedicated to our spiritual war against evil without compromise. Simply put, we cannot afford to live our lives with one foot in the church and one foot in the world. You know, Jesus Christ gives us a warning about the dangers of compromise in his letter to the church at Pergamos. If you would please, turn to Revelation 2. Revelation 2. And we'll read verses 12 through 17. And you may want to put a marker here because we will be referring back to these scriptures. Revelation 2, verses 12 through 17. It says, "And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas, my faithful martyr, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. Thus, you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I will come to you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it." Today, I'd like to thoroughly examine Christ's message to the church at Pergamos and review a pictorial presentation to aid our study. So the title for this message is Pergamos, Satan's Throne of Compromise. In order to properly understand Christ's message to the church at Pergamos, we must first understand a little bit about the history of the ancient city. Founded several centuries before the time of Christ, the city of Pergamos was located in the Caucasus Valley, approximately 50 miles north of Smyrna and about 15 miles inland from the Aegean Sea. According to the Ancient History Encyclopedia, when Alexander the Great died in 323 BCE, his generals divided the territory he had conquered, which resulted in a power struggle between them. Around this time, Pergamon was little more than a hilltop fortress with a settlement on its southern side. Following years of unrest, the city became part of the territory controlled by Lysimachus, one of the Macedonian generals. By this time, Pergamon embraced the polis, or city-state model of civic organization. Pergamus served as the capital city of the Greek dynasty of Attalid kings. Eumenes II, 197 to 159 BC, was the most illustrious king of the dynasty, and during his reign, the city reached its greatest height. Art and literature were encouraged, and in the city was a library of 200,000 volumes, which was exceeded only by the ancient library in Alexandria, Egypt. The books were of parchment, which was produced from the hides of animals and first used in this region, hence the word parchment, which is derived from the name of the town Pergamos. Though there were numerous impressive structures throughout the city, the most renowned was the altar of Zeus, which stood 40 feet high in height and was hailed as one of the wonders of the ancient world. And that's International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, 1939, Pergamos. So if we would, let's look at a few slides here. Next slide. These are the ruins of Pergamum. And you can see here's a theater view, and over here are some of the temples. Next slide. And here's from the right-hand side looking down. Again, this is the theater here. And over here's some of the other temples, which I'm going to explain where those are at in a second. Next slide. And here's from the other side looking back across into the city of today here in Turkey. Next slide. And here is the altar of Zeus, or where it stood actually. And this is what's actually left there right now in Turkey. What number is that? What number is that? Okay, one more. Okay, yeah, here's another overall view. Whoops. And here's the flashcards. So this is a nice color view. Okay. During the time of Attalus III, 138 to 133 BCE, Pergamon was handed over to the Roman Republic to be fully managed by the Roman people, and the kingdom was transformed into the Roman province of Asia, with Pergamon as its initial capital. In addition to providing government for the region, the city was a religious center. Beautiful temples were erected in honor of four pagan gods: Zeus, Dionysus, Athena, and Asclepius. Asclepius was the mythological god of healing, and it is interesting to note that the serpent and twine staff associated with him continues today as a symbol for modern medical arts. In addition to these pagan temples, the first temple in Asia Minor dedicated to the Roman Emperor was also erected at Pergamon in 29 BC by Gaius Octavius, who by that time had changed his name to Augustus Caesar. The name Augustus was a name previously reserved for the gods. In addition, Augustus took the role of Pontifex Maximus. The title Pontifex Maximus can be traced back in different forms to ancient Chaldean times. The Babylonian kings who were descended from Nimrod served as both king and priest of the pagan Babylonian mystery religion. As priests, they bore the title Pontifex Maximus, or Supreme Pontiff, meaning supreme pathfinder or bridge maker, representing the path or connection between this life and the next. When Medo-Persia conquered Babylon, the Babylonian region was maintained, but after a revolt of the priesthood, or excuse me, the Babylonian religion was maintained, but after a revolt of the priesthood, the priests of Babylon were driven out of Medo-Persia and established themselves at Pergamum, taking with them their titles and vestures. Years later, construction of the Trajan Temple began in the early 2nd century AD. Trajan was also retained the title Pontifex Maximus. The temple was completed by his successor and adopted son, Emperor Hadrian, Publius Aurelius Trajus Herodius Augustus, 76 to 138 AD, who reigned 117 to 138 AD, and was also worshipped at Pergamus. In the 4th century AD, Christian Emperor Gratian refused the title, and in the year 431 AD, the title Pontifex Maximus was taken over by Damascus, the Bishop of Rome. The present-day College of Cardinals in Rome is identical to the College of Pontiffs, with the Pontifex Maximus, or Pope, at the head. And the source for that is the Two Babylons, Alexander Hyssop, page 137. So let's look at some slides here. So here's a reconstructed model of Pergamus. This is the hilltop. You'll see here, this is the Agora, or public square. Here's the theater, which we saw the ruins. Over here we have the Dionysus Temple. The altar of Zeus, which we saw there was not much left. Just the, basically the steps. The Athena Temple, the library, and at the very top of the pinnacle was the Trajan Temple for the emperor worship. Next slide, please. And this is not sitting on top of the hill, but down here, if you notice at the entrance of the city, there's the Asclepion Temple. So this is just coming into the city here, and this is Pergamum, which is what's called today in Turkey. Next slide. This is a statue of Asclepius. And you'll notice the staff with the serpent coming around it, which you see. Next slide, please. Here's a typical coin from Pergamus. Notice the temple representation and the serpents on both sides. Did everybody see that? Next slide. Of course, we should all recognize this. You'll see this on the side of ambulances and doctor's offices. Next. This is a representation statue of Augustus Pontifex Maximus. And notice the robes that he's wearing. This is the robage of the Pontifex Maximus, or bridge builder. And here is some coinage, and I don't know if you can read that or not, but can everybody see that? The emperor's name, and then here is the title, Pontifex Maximus. What number are we on? Number 15, okay. So emperor worship, and I've got some notes here, but the thing I want you to know is the two last here. It says that people were required to worship the emperor. If not, it was considered an act of treason. So if you refused to burn incense before the emperor's image, it was a sign of treason or disloyalty. So Christians who refused to burn incense before the emperor's throne were persecuted even to the point of death. Now, here is the official papal title, because, as we said before, the Bishop of Rome took over the title Pontifex Maximus, and it resides with the Pope today. This is the Vatican. This is the symbol for the Pontifex Maximus. It's on the floor of St. Peter's Cathedral in the Vatican. Here's a coinage. This is Pope Pius VII, and again, the title Pontifex Maximus. And here's a more modern, this is Benedict the 16th, and again, Pontifex Maximus. Next slide. Now, we're talking about... Well, archaeologists have also been able to identify the remains of the massive library. The ruins of the ancient city were extensively excavated by the German government from 1879 to 1886. To date, the archaeological site of Pergamon has provided many fine works of Hellenistic and Roman art, but perhaps the most impressive is the altar, which now resides in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. The great altar was constructed during the reign of Eumenes II and has a surface area of some 36 by 34 meters. It's one of the most impressive works of art surviving from antiquity. The altar was constructed around a staircase, and the 2.3 meter high and 120 meter long frieze is topped by a colonnade hall. Sculpted in high relief, the frieze depicts lively representations of Zeus, Artemis, and other Olympian gods fighting the giants, symbolic of the victory of order over chaos. The gigantic monument is a convincing and lasting testimony to the power and prestige that was once enjoyed by this once great city. Archaeologists have also been able to identify the remains of the massive library. Based on the study of the holes for mounting the shelving, it is estimated that the reading room alone had a storage capacity of 20,000 papyri. Many were written on parchment. This is believed to be just 10% of the total for the entire library. Pergamus is now called Pergamon, is located in the modern nation of Turkey. Many of the archaeological finds from ancient Pergamus, as well as the entire altar of Zeus, can be viewed at the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, Germany. So here is the Pergamon, outside the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. Next slide, please. And inside the museum, of course, here is the model that we kind of looked at before. It shows you that massive, really impressive structure that was on top of the hill there in Pergamon. Next slide. This is a replica of the altar of Zeus in its full glory. And this is the model. You can see the people standing around. This is in a glass case out front in the museum. And next slide. And this is the actual altar of Zeus. And it was taken by archaeologists, German archaeologists, and brought to Berlin and set up in the museum. It's pretty impressive. Next. And you can see folks out here in the museum. Notice the representations in the side here. We'll get a little bit closer on the next slide. You see, this is representing the war of order over chaos. Next slide. Again, this is a little closer up. Notice the serpents. Next slide. You can see a little better here. And next slide. Another representation. So I think we kind of get the idea of that. Next slide. Now, I've included this. Anybody who's studied history has probably seen some of the shots of Hitler addressing the massive rallies that he had in the Nuremberg Stadium. I'm sure most of you are probably familiar with that. Next slide. This is the Nuremberg Stadium, and those of you who watch the History Channel, you probably remember at the end of the war, the Allies actually blew up this big swastika. You see it a lot of times, where they blew it up. Now, the interesting thing about this is Albert Speer designed this, and he used as his inspiration the altar of Zeus. So, if you can see the similarities. And I really don't think that's a coincidence, but... Okay, so moving on. So now that we have a little background on the history of Pergamus, let's once again look at Revelation 2, verses 12 through 17. It says, "And to the angel of the church in Pergamus write these things, says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. He, capital H, is obviously a reference to Christ, but the two-edged sword reference is also much more. Throughout the world, the symbol of Roman authority was the gladius, two-edged broadsword carried as the primary weapon of the Roman legions. The gladius was known as the sword that conquered the world. Christ's reference and use of this term proclaims that he has the word of God, which has much greater authority than the emperor of Rome. Those living in Pergamum would have easily understood this message. Verse 13, I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast in my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. Pergamus was the capital of the Roman province of Asia Minor in Asia Minor. Just as the initial local church at Pergamus was situated in a city where Satan swayed human politics, much of this work of God's church occurred within the bounds of the government of Satan's Eastern Roman Empire. Loyal subjects of the emperor were expected to pay homage and worship the emperor as a god under the title Pontifex Maximus. Those who refused to do so suffered extreme persecution. Christ's mentioning of the faithful martyr Antipas reveals that there were those in the church at Pergamus who were loyal in obeying Christ and resisting false worship even to the point of death. However, Christ goes on in verse 14 to chasten those who had compromised their faith and adopted false worship by adopting a go-along-to-get-along attitude. To them, he says, but I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrines of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. Regarding these verses, the old Radio Church of God published the following quote. In Revelation 2, 13 and 14, Christ, speaking to the church of Pergamus, says, I know thy works, even where Satan's seat is. Thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam. In Pergamus, which was outstandingly Satan's seat, the sun divinity, Baal, Balaam's doctor, was idolatrous sun worship. Numbers 25, 1 through 3, and 31, 16. It was worshipped under the form of a serpent and under the name of Asclepius, the man-instructing serpent. Maccabeus Saturnalia, Book 1, page 650. In Satan's seat, over 60 years after Christ's time, the main worship was sun and serpent. The sun and devil worship was transferred to Rome when Pergamus became part of the Roman Empire. According to the fundamental doctrines of the mysteries as brought from Pergamus to Rome, the sun was the only god. In Pergamus, the sun had been worshipped as a serpent. Meredith, see Paul, Today's Religious Doctrines, How Do They Begin? Installment 4, Plain Truth, February 1960, unquote. In addition to those who held the doctrine of Balaam, in verse 15, Christ says, thus you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. According to Rhenius Adversus Heresus, Book 1, Chapter 26, Verse 3, quote, the reference to the Nicolaitans seems to refer to possible Gnostics who wrongly felt that various of their physical actions and deeds were not of spiritual consequence. The Nicolaitans were seemingly among those who changed the grace of our God into a license for immorality, Jude 4, NIV, and or were certain semi-Gnostics who instituted an anti-biblical practices. They understood a false gospel. Arrhenius said that they claimed to be descended from the deacon Nicholas in Acts 6:5, and that they had led lives of unrestrained indulgence, unquote. Though there is much debate about the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, there can be no doubt that it was a form of false teaching which Christ says he hates, and goes on in verse 16 to instruct them to repent, or else I will come to you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. Finally, Christ ends his message to Pergamus with two encouraging and intriguing statements. In verse 17, he says, he who has an ear, Let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat. You don't have to turn there, but this is obviously a reference to eternal life, as stated by Christ in John 6, 48-51. Here Jesus said, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which come down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. Continuing on in Revelation 2, 17, Christ says, And I will give him a white stone, and on that stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. This reference would have made perfect sense to those living in Pergamum in that day. The white stone is a symbol of lasting endurance or permanence, as opposed to the fragileness and temporary nature of the writings on parchment paper for which the city was noted. In addition, Christ says he will give those who overcome a new name. Brethren, the name with which Christ refers is the family name of God. This reference would have made perfect sense to those living in Pergamos at the time. Christ was telling them that unlike Octavius, who had declared himself a god and taken for himself the name Augustus, a name previously only used in reference to pagan gods, the Christians in Pergamos, as well as those of us here today who overcome and do not compromise our faith, will be given the name of the true God when we are born again as spirit beings in the family of God. What a wonderful promise, brethren. On May 10, 1940, following his failed attempt to achieve peace through compromise with Nazi Germany and the outbreak of war in Europe, Neville Chamberlain formally resigned as Prime Minister of England. His successor, Winston Churchill, took office as the new Prime Minister that same day. Churchill, unlike Chamberlain, had no stomach for compromise with evil, as evidenced by his now famous speech in which he declared, We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Brethren, do we have that same type of attitude in our spiritual war? Or have we at times adopted a go-along-to-get-along attitude? Do we fully resist false teaching and pagan worship? Or do we sometimes make compromises with God's instructions, as some in Pergamos were doing? You know, we all should recall the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Next slide, please. Who, though threatened with death, refused to bow down and worship the golden image of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. Today we have seen that there was at least one Christian in Pergamos named Antipas who followed their example and was martyred for his faithfulness to God. We have also seen that there were those who had adopted a spirit of compromise and participated in both false teachings and false worship. So brethren, we must ask ourselves, had we been there in Pergamos, would we have held firm to our faith like Antipas? Or would we compromise and worship the emperor to avoid being martyred? Brethren, a time is coming in the near future when a new empire partnered with a great false religious system identified in Revelation 17:5 as Mystery Babylon, the Great, the Mother of Harlots, and the Abominations of the Earth will ask true Christians to make that same choice. If you would please turn to Revelation 13. Revelation 13. We'll read verses 11 through 15. Revelation 13, 11 through 15. It says, Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. What will we do if faced with this choice in the future? Will we compromise? I think the answer to this question may be found in what we're doing today. Do we ever go along with the world to get along? We won't turn there, but James 4:4 says, "Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." Brethren, may we all resolve this day to fight the good fight of faith without falter and never bow down before Satan's throne of compromise.